Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is the Distraction Pieces podcast number 7. My name is Scroobius Pip, and this week's guest is the legendary comic book, graphic novel, and normal novel writer, Warren Ellis. This was an exciting one. I was excited about this because as soon as we did number 3 with Alan Moore, we had loads of people requesting. Basically, everyone seemed to ask for either Warren Ellis, Garth Ennis, a lot of Ellis's, or I think they mentioned Hickman, a few others. So it was good that we already had a Warren Ellis lined up and in the bag. He wrote some of the best comic books of all time. But before I get onto that, I should do the sponsors, because we're sponsored, as ever, by Speech Development Records. We've got loads of new products out now. We've got kind of a winter range if you want to come and look at our coats, jumpers, all that. It's my record label, if I've not mentioned that a million times at the beginning of every damn podcast. But come to scroobiuspip.co.uk and check us out. We're also sponsored for the last time this week. So, we're sponsored for the last time by a Redshift, a Rebels. It's a clothing company who decide that instead of marketing, they put their money into music and art and culture and supporting good things. So these adverts, I've given them a payback for when they supported me at the beginning of my career. They put out a mixtape for me, an EP, helped me tour, all sorts of things. So, I mean, aside from their good ethics, they've got awesome clothes and hats. So go to Redshift, a Rebels, and you can get a 25% discount, I think, if you enter the code free cheese. So go and check them out. I said this is our last week being sponsored by them, though, so do feel free to hit me up if you have a company or product that you might think is right for sponsoring this podcast. A bit of an odd one, but yeah, scroobiuspipio@hotmail.co.uk. Yes, I still fuck with Hotmail. And not only, it's not even a .com, it's a .co.uk. So yeah, give me a shout if you'd be interested in advertising on the podcast. I basically need to pay for the bandwidth and whatnot so you can all keep getting this for free. I don't want to start charging. So that's how we do it. But the final sponsor is onit.com, who are a human optimization company. They sell a lot of exercise stuff like battle ropes and maces and kettlebells, all sorts. But they also do a lot of and nootropics, which the one that I've used before is Alpha Brain, and it's kind of, you take it and it's said to kind of make you sharper. I find it kind of, I describe it as, it feels like it goes around and switches all the lights on without me having to do it as such. But there is question marks over it all. So if you go on the website, they've got loads of facts about it and all the details and results of tests and things like that. So if you go to onit.com/scroobiuspip, everything you buy will be 10% off, and by doing so you will also be helping fund the podcast and keep it free and so on and so forth. So thank you very much for doing that. You can hit me up at @scroobiuspipio on Twitter or Instagram or facebook.com/scroobiuspip. I think that's about everything, isn't it? This week's guest is Warren Ellis. I can't wait for a lot of on Instagram in particular, I've got a lot of followers who are real hard comic book nerds like myself, and everyone seemed to love the Alan Moore one, but the one criticism there seemed to be was we maybe didn't nerd out quite enough over comics. You're in for a treat, ladies and gentlemen, because in this one, Warren allows me to go full nerd mode numerous times, and we really get into his whole career. Obviously, his Marvel work, his DC work, Transmet being one of the greatest comic book creations of all time. So we cover everything, ladies and gentlemen, from the past to what his plans are for the future. So you're in for a treat here. So thank you for tuning in. I will be back at the end with a little bit more information, but until then, enjoy.
Before we get started, I haven't listened to the others. What are our content restrictions?
There are no content restrictions.
Hallelujah, because I swear a lot when I'm tired.
No, that's perfect. In fact, we have already started, because I think that's a good introduction to start with the restriction of...
the lack of content restriction. So,
all right, then.
Yeah,
all right.
You can say anything you want, and we will. But I'm joined here with by Warren Ellis. How you doing, sir?
I'm knackered. I've been up less than 3 hours, so it's still morning. This is Warren's rule.
It certainly
Warren
is.
Warren has been awake less than 3 hours. It's still morning.
I like the fact that we both have done the horrible journey in from Essex today. For some reason, instead of just meeting in Essex, which it didn't even cross my mind.
I don't even know why we didn't do that.
It's quite a mystery, isn't it? We both arrived here.
Well, we would have had to meet in bloody Shenfield or something.
Yeah,
I don't think there's anything there apart from the train line.
Yeah, maybe not.
Shenfield terrifies my daughter because she's convinced that if she ever got off there, she'd never be seen again. It's the Twilight Zone.
Yeah, it's a weird and wonderful place. I only know of it because of the train station.
Yeah,
I'm not familiar with any
universe, but there's nothing there.
Yeah, it's quite mysterious. But yeah, you enjoyed your wonderful journey into London. I know you're a big fan of travelling in the winter on the train.
Oh yeah, unheated rattle trap all the way up from Southend Vic, and then they're tearing up the embankment, because I understand Comedy Boris wants to stick a bicycle lane.
Oh, perfect.
From Blackfriars all the way up the embankment. So the embankment's been torn up.
You know, I'm sure Boris would have thought that through. It's not like him to go off half-cocked and unconsidered.
Not. I remember when he got voted in and I emailed and called most of my friends in London saying, what the fuck were you thinking? And they all said, every single one said, well, I thought it'd be funny. I didn't think anyone else would vote for him.
Yeah, yeah. The amount of people that voted, assuming it would be an entertaining thing.
Yeah.
It was amusing because he is very funny on Have I Got News For You? But so are a lot of people.
Well, so
wouldn't particularly want them to run.
Well, yeah, I mean, so's Paul Merton, but I wouldn't give him charge of my fucking bath.
No. And he's been pushing for that for a long time. I know you're constantly having to hold him back on that one. But yeah, anyway, let's start with discussing you. We're both coming in from Essex, and you are an Essex boy from birth, I assume.
An Essex boy from birth, born in Rochford, everyone else in the bloody area. Rochford Hospital,
yeah.
Which mostly isn't there now. They knocked down a maternity ward. They tried to raise the entire hospital down. But someone somehow got a paper that said the incinerator at Rochford was an object of like national architectural importance.
Oh, wow.
So there's now just the incinerator and the chimney, because in Essex we like fire.
Yeah, that's the bit that's essential, not the bit that brings life.
No, giving life to, you know, millions of people. No, fire and burning shit. That's what we like in Essex.
So
that's
how was it growing up in Rochford? Did you stay in Rochford or did you
Rochford,
move around?
That's
where the hospital was, of course,
ward,
yeah.
for the entire area. I grew up mostly in Thundersley.
Amazing. That's I spent a lot of my youth there because my dad worked at the Hobson's factory in Thundersley, which is at the top of Bread and Cheese Hill.
That's right.
So
yeah.
The only reason I knew of Thundersley was because that's where Dad worked.
Yeah,
so
that bloody hill. I had a girlfriend down the bottom of Bread and Cheese Hill.
Oh dear.
Walk back up there at 2 o'clock in the fucking morning.
That's a hell of a hill.
You know, that's all Viking territory around
there. Oh really? No, I didn't know that at all.
Yeah, Thundersley. It's a corruption of the original name, which meant Thor's sacred grove.
Oh, wow.
It was a place of worship for Thor.
You know what? I did hear some mention of that in something I was listening to a while ago and thought, it's crazy of all the places I'm hearing about Thundersley.
Yeah, there are two on the east coast. There's Thundersley in Essex, mm-hmm. and there's another Thundersley up by Ipswich, because that whole side of the country was owned by the Vikings for a long time. That was the Danelaw.
Yeah.
So the local mythology had it that every Thursday Thor would fly over both Thundersleys.
Yeah, that's amazing.
But yeah, it's all Viking. All the towns in the area with Lee or Lay on the end, they're all Viking clearances.
That's amazing. I didn't know that at all. Do you have any religious leanings? Just thinking of Odinism, you know, a fascinating religion to choose with its, you know, its standing points being in drinking, sex,
according
fighting.
To some website I saw once, I'm in fact a celebrity atheist.
A celebrity atheist,
yeah.
There we go. When does that TV series start?
Oh, that'd be funny, yeah. And I'm a distinguished supporter of the British Humanist Association.
Excellent.
Which does a lot of good work in actually trying to bring an understanding of atheism and humanism.
That's fantastic. So when did you... Did you grow up an atheist, or was that a...
My dad... I'm not convinced my dad had any kind of religious affiliation. Yeah. I don't think we ever really talked about it, but his religious affiliation was mostly, I don't give a fuck, leave me alone.
Yeah.
My mother was a common old garden British Christian, which meant she never went to church or was observant or anything.
It's just, you tick that box.
The Jesus card, tick that box.
Yeah.
So she did make me go to Sunday school when I was a kid. But that stopped when I had a favourite TV show on Sunday mornings and I said, I don't want to go to Sunday school. And she said, well, Jesus loves you, you must go to Sunday school. And my dad said, shut up and leave him alone.
It's fascinating, isn't it? Because I had parents that aren't particularly religious in any way, but I went to a Catholic school because they'd gone to a Catholic school and they felt it was good to learn that and have that knowledge. But as soon as I left, they were like, yeah, just make your own mind up. Don't really...
Nice.
Neither of them have been to church since I was a child,
Catholic
I don't
school,
think.
Because I used to hear horror stories when I was a kid.
I went to St. Thomas More High School for Boys in Southend.
Oh, right.
And I was there, just for... At secondary school, until 16, okay. I guess.
So I had a friend when I was a kid who went to one of the small Catholic schools, the run by nuns, proper job.
Yeah.
And
scariness.
Scary shit.
Delightful.
Beatings, lashings, locked in the cupboard for 6 hours, the whole nine yards, you know.
Yeah, all in the name of our Lord.
Oh, yes. Yes. Jesus loves us, that's why he locks us in cupboards.
So how was it in Southend? And, what kind of... How did you find your path to writing? I remember reading or seeing an interview with you somewhere saying that you'd basically done every horrible job before getting to writing.
I've done all kinds of horrible jobs. I used to work in Crampon's Garden Centre on the Rayleigh Road.
Brilliant. I know it well.
Yeah. I was there weekends for 2 years lifting like bags of peat and shit.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
Literally
bags of peat and shit. When I was young and strong, I was a bronzed young giant, Pip.
Yeah, perfect.
Yeah, that faded fast. Let's see. I worked for the official receiver in bankruptcy for 6 months.
Oh, wow.
Now, that was...
So what were your duties
that
there?
That was a depressing job.
Yeah, I'd imagine.
My duties were many and various. Mostly it was just having to process files out, which required me to read the life stories of people who had been made bankrupt by the official receiver.
Oh, jeez.
And this is back in the 80s, where bankruptcy was a lot tougher than it is now. Where you would be made bankrupt for like a minimum of 5 years, and at some point the official receiver would essentially sell your case to a solicitor's firm for them to complete the administration of. So the government was essentially just selling you to the private sector.
Yeah.
And grim, grim stories.
Do you think experiencing things like that and having a variation of jobs that aren't particularly enjoyable, do you think that influenced the way you write and built you as a writer and as a, or more just as a person and the way you think of society and the way you think of how things
it's
are?
It's entirely possible. I mean...
Because a job like that, you must have witnessed and read about a lot of horrible things.
Yeah, I mean, I was in college till I was 18. That naturally politicises you anyway because you're a student.
Of course.
Student, but, student politics happen. But coming out of that and then like working in shops for a while and then going into bankruptcy, that can't help but politicise you in a deeper way because you can't read these things and say, oh, well, they deserved it.
Yeah.
You can only come out of reading those case studies and think, we should not have to live like this.
Yeah,
this
should
not happen
right
to anybody.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
That must have been a harrowing introduction. When did you kind of start writing and find that as your way? And was it initially always in comic books, or did you at college were you writing in any other form?
I dabbled in prose in college. I mean, I was a small press kid in my teens doing comics and articles and bits and pieces. Picked up a little bit of paid comics work in college, I think. And then, like I say, it was a succession of shitty jobs and then a few years on the dole.
Right.
So it was just writing. I had stopped reading comics for a chunk of my teens, as you do.
Yeah, yeah.
And then sort of rediscovered them again. And comics just still, I mean, to this day, even though I do less than I used to, still fascinate me because they're the visual narrative medium without filters.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just you and your artist and the audience.
Yeah,
and
yeah, completely. And particularly...
You can't do that in any other visual narrative.
Particularly at that point, and I mean... still now, but particularly at that point, it's the only medium where it's limitless.
Yes.
It's limitless. It's what you can imagine. At that point, if you wanted to film or to do film or TV with a lot of these things, there were restrictions. Obviously there are now, but it's more time restrictions that you'd be able to make these things real. But yeah,
right.
At that point, it seems that a comic book art and writing was the one, a restraint-free form of going, right, where can my imagination literally take me in the visual medium?
I mean, television is the one visual narrative medium where there's, if you're lucky, no more time restriction.
Yeah.
But you've still got those, like, 100 or 200 people.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
Between you and the audience.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're very rarely going to be in a position where you can say exactly what you want in exactly the way you want to say it.
Yeah.
And those limits just don't really exist in comics. Frankly, I mean, there's less of them in the commercial end of comics than there used to be.
Yeah, yeah, completely. There's all ends of it. How did a young man in Southend in Essex jump to writing for Marvel, for example? Because was it quite early on in your actual in your comic book career you were in with Marvel, was it not?
In the early 20s, I started doing work for British comics publishers.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if it's true now, but back then part of the culture was you'd go to the big comics conventions in London and Glasgow back then. And they were the best because I love Glasgow.
Yeah, it's a great place.
That was such fun. And you would like naturally meet editors from other companies and from America. The Americans would always send people over to have a sniff around. Or they would have read your stuff and they'll come looking for you if you were lucky. And I became friends with an editor at Marvel called Marie Javins.
Mm-hmm.
And with Archie Goodwin, rest his soul, who was at the time the best and most distinguished editor in American comics.
Yeah.
And he bought something of mine when he was at DC. And that gave Marie Javins the tool she needed to go to her bosses at Marvel and say, Warren's just sold something to Archie Goodwin.
So we need to...
And so she got me in at Marvel.
That's great. That's great. And how did that work? Were you spending a lot of time in the US all of a sudden, or were you working from
remote? I mean, back then it was the days of typescript photocopies and Federal Express.
Wow, yeah.
Back when dinosaurs roamed the earth.
Yeah.
Once I got like ensconced at Marvel, because I did some like fringy work at Marvel, mm-hmm. and then they started deciding I was a safe-ish pair of hands and were bringing me into the groups of books they had then.
Yeah, sure.
Like their science fiction line, the Marvel 2099 line.
I remember the first thing I read of yours was the Doom 2099. I remember getting really into that whole movement where they were bringing everything into the future, essentially, and the Doom one was one of the ones I was a massive fan of. So how was that to suddenly have these characters in your hands? Was there a level of
I never went into this to do superhero comics. What fascinated me about the 2099 stuff is they were trying to do as pure a science fiction experience as they could.
Yeah, yeah, completely.
Just using, I mean, in the case of Doom, I mean, Doom was the only extant Marvel character there.
Yeah.
And the way the previous writer and creator, John Francis Moore, had set it up is you didn't even really know if he was Doom.
Yeah.
So you were basically just getting to write a science fiction book at Marvel.
Yeah, 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 yeah. Right. It just happened to have a name or a familiar framework at most.
Yeah, that was it. So,
that's great. And again, I guess that also takes any nerves or restriction off you as a writer, of having to respect any particular previous stories of that character or concepts or anything like that. You can literally just go, right, this is...
Continuity in those days was murder.
Yeah.
It was so dense and so convoluted. Really? And so many of the editors believed it was their job to defend it.
Yeah,
I believe
craziness.
They even had a member of staff who essentially his entire job was to follow, annotate and defend continuity.
Who was the genius that one day turned around and went, there's multiple universes and variations of the characters?
Oh, they already had that.
So if you can accept
and they
that.
Had their separate lists for those.
Oh, wow.
Oh, yeah.
Continuity within the thing that is kind of allowing you to bend the continuity. That's the irony there.
Oh, yeah. It was absolutely choking back then.
Yeah.
Particularly once I did a couple of years on the X-Men books back then.
Yeah.
Mostly for profile building purposes.
I was going to say, how was that?
It was terrible for them because I didn't know. They asked me to take over this book, this particular X-Men book that was set in Britain. And I said, love to. Don't know who any of these characters are. Can you start sending me reference? Because this was still pre-internet.
Wow.
Damn. When I started writing that, I think we were still living in the flat and there was no internet connection. So I had to get them to FedEx me reams and reams and reams of photocopied pages from books.
Wow.
I had to read thousands of pages of stuff to be able to research this to my liking.
Yeah.
I spent 2-3 years basically learning superhero comics.
That's crazy, because as a fan, I mean, I'm a fan of a lot of comics, but I am a fan of superhero comics. It's so wonderfully odd to hear that you get this in your hands, and for me, a lot of the superhero stuff that I've loved has been your work, and to learn that you never really knew about
really
it and really into it. When I was a kid,
the only superhero comics that I really looked at more than once were like Frank Miller on Daredevil, Doug Mensch and Bill Sienkiewicz on Moon Knight, Alan Moore's stuff, maybe a smattering of other things that don't occur to me at the present time. I was never a big student of the form.
Yeah.
So I got thousands of pages sent over from Marvel. I bought tons and tons of like reprint omnibuses and shit. And spent years just learning superhero comics, which is hanging got planetary.
Yeah.
Because I'd filled my head with this stuff and there's only so much space in there, mate.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was starting to take up the parts of my brain that I used to, remember to do the washing up.
Yeah.
So I had to download it, I had to get it all out, and that's what Planetary was.
That's amazing. So how was it, though, in the going from, obviously, everything that went on at Marvel, you then were over to DC, right, was the Authority kind of next?
Oh, right.
In line? Because, again, that was an odd one of superhero, but...
I might already have been at Vertigo, or at least Helix, while I was finishing up at Marvel. I think there was an overlap.
A crossover, sure.
But, yeah, then I was doing Transmitter Helix, which got moved over to Vertigo. I had been working at Wildstorm, that was still a separate company, at Image.
Yeah.
Probably just as I finished up at Marvel.
Yeah.
And
I love Image. Have always been good at kind of having those kind of imprints or whatever of just, I don't know, they feel like the great underdog in the with the overlords of Marvel and DC.
Image was like the blanket label name, but each of the separate Image creators had their own label within it.
Yeah.
So I was over there doing Stormwatch for a couple of years, which nobody was reading. And I happened to see the sales figures. I was like a couple of years into it, I think. I think we'd just relaunched it, and I happened to see the sales figures, and I was like, Jesus Christ. So I rung up Scott Doombeer, I think it probably was, at Wildstorm, and said, I've just seen the sales figures of Stormwatch. Don't get me wrong. I love it that you send me money.
Yeah.
But we must be past the point where it's just costing you a lot to print this. Why are we still doing this book? Why haven't you fired me or cancelled it? And they said to me, well, we're really liking reading the scripts here. We want to know what happens next.
It's beautiful.
We really like reading it, so we're paying you so we can read it, basically.
That's amazing. How beautiful is that, though? Awful. It's crazy, isn't it?
Because they were just burning money because they wanted to read this.
But that shows how good the script was, right?
Well, I mean,
if they're willing to, you know, the mass public haven't heard it yet, but if they're willing to invest that to find out what's next, what's going
to
happen next.
But it's also possible they were all mental.
There's always that.
I just done my bit with Hitch on Stormwatch, and I sat down and I thought, how can I keep doing this? And because I felt like I was coming to the end of the job anyway, and that had certainly accelerated my feelings. And it's like, how can I keep doing this and have it make money for them? Because I feel really guilty at this point. Yeah. And I didn't own it. They owned it. But I just felt really bad for them. And I was looking at Hitch's pages one night, Brian Hitch.
Yeah.
And that's when I started to put together The Authority.
Yeah.
Which, you know, I've since described, I know, as like Stormwatch with the plot characters and intelligence stripped out of it.
But it went down well, right? And it was quite...
The Authority was a hit. Yeah.
And kind of, it felt like the only thing that springs to mind, really, of DC's... Yeah, to counter your X-Men or your Avengers or things like this, it was the one that really seemed to work as,
and of course,
as a
what
collective.
As
a new collective, at least, rather than just going, here's characters, let's put them together.
And of course, the weird thing was, while I was putting together Authority and the Planetary, I think we were, in fact, probably not more than 6 weeks away from the first issue of the Authority, DC bought Wildstorm.
Right.
So these were going to be DC... books, essentially.
Right, I see.
So which was odd. I mean, they brought us all into town. They brought us all into London except Alan. Alan Moore, because he was doing stuff at Wildstorm and he had issues with DC.
Of course,
so
yes.
So they actually went to his house in Northampton to break the news to him first in person.
I went there myself to record a podcast a few weeks back that we've had on this.
I remember Jim Lee saying to me, so we got out of the train station, he wasn't there, and we walked outside the train station, and there was Alan Moore getting out of a cab with what looked like a cudgel in his hand. And Jim says, and I thought, someone's told him already and he's come to kill us. It was his cane. It was when Alan had started affecting a cane.
Yeah, that's amazing, though.
They literally thought Alan was getting out of a cab to beat them
to attack
death in the
them
street.
Because of the DC affiliation. Yeah. How did are you all feel about that? Because obviously it's going from this very beautiful independent thing that, as I said, are continuing to commission a book that they're not selling because they're interested in it. Right. So the beauty of that to being one of the biggest companies in the world.
There was an editorial firewall at that point between DC and Wildstorm.
Right.
So we would basically continue to do whatever we liked.
And they would then just put that out.
That's right.
Surely that's... I mean, I'm sure some people would say otherwise, but surely that's only a good thing if you're getting to make the comics you were previously making but plugging into the bigger network or distribution or anything of someone like DC.
Well, you've got to see it from the perspective of companies as corporations that change their leaves with the season.
Right, yeah, of course.
They do have a general personality of their own, but that is sharpened or softened by whoever is working there at the time.
Yeah, yeah.
So at the time, DC was generally quite laissez-faire in a lot of things, but had a very strong sense of who they were as a company.
Yeah.
And so some people there would express that more sharply than others.
Right, I see. I mean, needless to say, DC wouldn't be making the decision to keep making something just because they want to read the script effectively.
No.
So
no,
that's kind of, I guess, the difference.
Wildstorm was totally seat of the pants.
Yeah. I love it.
To the
I
point where, and this was unusual for a big company at the time, their cover art policy was, draw whatever you like, we don't much care.
Brilliant.
So long as it's in roughly on time. There was absolutely no cover art policy at all.
That's craziness.
Whoever was drawing it decided what it was going to be.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
I love that. I love that. Just kind of okay. We'll see where it
and
lands.
It was loose enough that I could do things in terms of how something was presented that were very hard to do elsewhere. Like I could get the colorist cover credited.
Yeah,
which sounds like nothing, but that wasn't happening at the time.
Well, things like that is obviously a great freedom there, because my initial thought there was, how can a company that does this for a living not be aware that the cover art is of huge importance? You can have the best story in the world, but if the cover isn't good, it could still do great, but not it won't pull them new readers in.
And also, I mean, there's a lack of understanding of how crucial a colourist is.
Yeah, completely.
And in Laura's case, Laura Martin, who I specifically got hired for Authority and Planetary, she was part of the team as much as John O'Brien were.
Yeah.
Because a bad colourist will murder a good artist.
Yes, completely.
And for those books, I needed a very inventive colourist as well as a good colourist.
Fantastic.
And Laura was brilliant. She won so many awards for her work on Authority, Planetary, and books after that.
But what's your dream team?
Oh, there's no such
thing.
Just
jumping into that right now as off the trail that we were going on. Come on, you've got to have a... If you were deciding, right...
I've
had this story forever on waiting.
Right, but every story is
different. Yeah, unique, I guess, yeah.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
I mean, I love Ben Templesmith, but he wouldn't do the sort of job on Trees that Jason Howard does.
Yeah, sure.
Jason Howard I wrote it for him. Jason's ideal for it. I love Ben to death, but Trees ain't Trees without Jason.
Yeah. It's really interesting how... a lot of people won't realise how important everyone in the team is, I guess. In the nature of it, there's people that... there's certain books... it's hard to explain. There's certain artists that I love everything they draw, but then there's certain books that I wouldn't want them to have drawn, if you know what I mean. It's like, I love this artist, but
well, here's another
I don't
example.
Want him on this book.
Have you seen Supreme Blue Rose?
No, I haven't. No.
Okay. It's a sort of David Lynchian take... on superhero fiction.
Interesting, yeah.
Which means it wouldn't work if Brian Hitch drew it.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it would be bombastic and incredibly pristine and clear of line and highly detailed.
Whereas if you're doing anything that's a superhero base, you'd often think Hitch would be someone that you'd go straight at the top of your list. So
but
that's
no,
great. That
it'd have to be Tula. It's got to be misty and blurry and indistinct. And almost romantic in a way that Brian's stuff isn't.
Yeah, that's great. Is there anyone you've not worked with that you'd like to, from a colourist or artist?
I always, there's a couple who died. I always wanted to work with Gil Kane.
Right.
I've actually got some of his original art, and his stuff just fascinated me.
Yeah.
He was like a classical adventure comics artist, but he had incredible texture to his line. And when he did crime stuff, which he did briefly in the 60s, it came out, because of the weird angles he used, it came out like one of those neo-noir weird films of the late 60s, Point Blank.
Yeah. Amazing.
That weird edge to it. I would have loved to have done something with him. But when I got into the business, he was an old guy.
Yeah.
I remember they hired him for, I did a crossover book, Stormwatch Aliens.
Oh, wow. That's a hell of a crossover.
They used to like doing, back in the 90s, crossovers between films and comics properties.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And they hired Gil Kane to do the cover. And they said to him, he's sent the copies of Stormwatch. And it's like, here's Stormwatch versus aliens. You know? And he's like, yeah, I got it. And then the cover comes back and... it's Stormwatch versus 1950s bug-eyed aliens with the big glass helmets and the aliens from The Simpsons.
Yeah,
one had. I guess he'd never seen the movies.
The movies, he didn't. That's brilliant. I love that. What's your process when when working with an artist. Obviously, you hear of infamously of the Stan Lee process of kind of almost giving a loose guideline, then getting the artist to draw everything, and then writing to the art. Yeah, essentially,
it's actually called Marvel style.
The Marvel style, yeah, yeah.
It's bloody horrible, and I won't use it.
Yeah. So just explain that a little better than I just have. It's essentially
style is where the writer will write something that's supposed to look like an outline.
Yeah.
I've seen other people's Marvel style plots, as they're called, and some of them read like fucking telegrams.
Yeah.
But it's supposed to be an outline of the story, and the artist will then go away and break that down into penciled art.
Yeah.
And then it's sent back to the writer, who writes all the dialogue and captions and so forth.
That's craziness.
The way it used to, I don't know how it works now because I haven't done it in a long time. What used to happen is you used to be sent giant photocopies of the pencil art,
mm-hmm.
and you were supposed to write the dialogue and number all the dialogue and captions and so forth per page, and then you were supposed to take a marker and you were supposed to draw the balloons on the photocopies of the penciled art.
That's amazing.
And number them. So the letterer get the lettering script and these photocopies you've doodled on.
And do it.
And then match, and then do them on the art and match them up like that.
It's crazy to think, because
it's horrible.
It's crazy to think that a story can come together like that. And part of me, the kind of the romantic side, kind of is excited that some good stories have come from that. Because it's kind of beautiful that feels like such a broken up way to write, that if it happens, I like the old thing of Bowie supposedly picking words out of a hat to write some of his lyrics, and then it happens to have written some of the best songs ever. There's kind of a beauty in that, but I can't imagine who would sit down and go, I've got this idea, here's how I'm going to execute it.
But it also it can lead to a real fight between the writer and the artist.
Right, yeah.
And the famous example I use... it was that issue of X-Men where Jean Grey dies.
Yeah.
Yeah, don't ask me what number it was, but it was a famous one.
Yeah.
And in the comics, she's just died, and Cyclops is terribly sad. He's got all the feels, bless him.
Yeah.
And he's dropping to his knees and crying. All right. But John Byrne has done that in some fairly small panels.
Yeah.
But the writer, Chris Claremont, had a lot more to say than that.
Right.
So he gives...
So he didn't have the space.
And he's like... And he doesn't leave it alone. He's like, oh, okay, John's done this. I guess it does most of the work. Maybe I can just drop a line in because they're working my old stuff.
Yeah.
But instead, oh, no, he gives Cyclops such a huge monologue that when you look at the page, it actually looks like Cyclops is being crushed to his knees by the weight of the speech balloon over his head.
Yeah. Oh, that's amazing.
That's the writer and artist at war.
That's not great.
The one time I did a big Marvel style job, it was at the request of the artist, which is a guy called George Perez.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not happy about it, but it was at his request. He says, it's how I work best. So I went and read a bunch of his stuff and tried to get a feel for it, and then wrote this thing, Marvel style. Very long outline, but still. And then, of course, I get the giant photocopied pages back to stick the lettering on. And George likes small panels.
Right.
And it turns out some artists will leave like blank or dead spaces or negative space in the panel as an indication of where you can stick some lettering.
Yeah.
George thinks he does that, but he can't stop himself from drawing.
From filling it all, yeah.
And it was all filled with the most exquisite detail. And this is penciled out, technically rough art, and it looked like a grey printed page for a silent comic, because every millimetre was filled with exquisite penciled detail.
It's such a skill to learn. It instantly makes me think when me and Dan Lissac first started working together, it took us a while, and Dan will concede, or he was the one that highlighted it to me. It wasn't until the second record that he learned, as a producer, he can leave space for the words. He doesn't have to go, right, I've got to fill everything and make all this sound. I've got points I can just let the vocals do what they're doing rather than fill everything. And that's
negative space is a huge thing. And the thing is, George thinks it is negative space because he's like, Well, it's just detail. You can cover that, but you can't because it's gorgeous. Detail. It's gorgeous. It took me weeks. It took me weeks to write the letter and script on that.
It's wonderfully humble of him, I guess, that he's seeing this beautiful art.
I got an email back saying, this is one of the tightest letter and scripts I've ever seen. It's so spare. You do so much with such an economy of words. Yeah.
Not through choice.
Die, you bastard. That took me like 8 weeks.
That's amazing. So what is your general process in writing? Do you prefer... Will you, as the writer, not have the control, but certainly be the lead in the dance with the artist. Will you write out your story in greater detail?
When I'm creating something new, the first thing I do, I've usually been talking with an artist about working together and we'll agree we're going to do something.
Yeah.
So the first thing I do is I send an email to the artist. I say, write me a list of all the things you love, all the things you want to draw, your favourite books, films, TV shows and bits of music.
Yeah.
Tell me what you love. Tell me what you want to do. And I'll assemble a list out of that.
Love it.
And I'll get a sense of what they want to do. And then we'll talk generally about, you know, what their favourite comics were, where they see themselves in 5 years, what it is, what they really want to do and say.
Yeah.
And then I'll start, like, generating something out of that. I'll put that together with what I'm in the mood to say that year. And I'll try and come up with something that assembles it all.
That's wonderful that it makes it an interview.
In the case of Injection, Geordie, the colourist, was in at the start as well. So I got a list from her too.
That's great. So it's very much an interview process on the goals as a writer rather than the goals as a story, essentially, or the goals as an artist or whatever, or what you want to get across and everything that comes in to influence that rather than just,
well,
what do you want to draw like? I want to draw a bit like this.
Yeah, yeah. It's got to be a collaboration on like the basic genetic level.
Yeah,
because
amazing.
Once you're into production, parts of collaboration go away. You're not talking so much about... the nuts and bolts of it. Yeah, I'm into the writing, they're into drawing. So it really happens right at the start where we're trying to fuse whatever we're all interested in into one thing.
Yeah.
On trees, Jason Howard, it was just... Jason, like, collects art. He's got a big file, like a mood board type file of stuff he likes, art he likes, and he just sent me a couple of folders full of that. And there was like landscapes, sense of scale, some little pen drawings he'd done himself to amuse himself because they were very unlike the superhero comics he was doing at the time. And trees came from all that. Science fiction, robots, landscape shots and these little pen portraits of people he'd seen on the street.
Oh, beautiful.
Things like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, it all came from that.
That's amazing. So, I mean, I've given it at least 40 minutes into the chat before getting onto a Transmetropolitan, which was obviously, you know, a big talking point, and I've held off well. But yeah, I mean, it's not the first thing I read by you. In fact, I was really late to it because it was one that was, it was actually a Twitter conversation with Jonathan Ross, of all people, that I was discussing in general artists I like and writers I like. And I'd resisted Transmet because it had a beginning, a middle, and an end. Mm. And that was a lot to undertake when you're working on a record and things like that.
Right.
Whereas stepping into Venom or some character that's got, you can't get the beginning, the middle, and end. It's so varied and in so many different places. It's easy to read a short run of the Fantastic Four or a short run of this. Whereas Transmet felt like an undertaking in that respect. And after that conversation...
1,200 pages, 1,300 pages, somewhere around there.
Yeah, so it was one thing. But then as soon as I started, obviously, I didn't get anything else done until I was finished. So, I mean, but it's amazing. How was that as... Or where do you see that in your career and as your offerings? Because it felt to me, as soon as I started reading it, as the great... This is what I've been trying to do. This is what I've been like... And, you know, as you were saying, where you do... Or we're doing superhero stuff because it was a means to an end, or, you know, it wasn't necessarily... It felt like this was the point where you got seemingly freedom and control to go, right, here's my
in some sense
here's my
it
statement.
Was coming back because I started out doing grim science fiction graphic novels, Lazarus Churchyard and things like that.
Of course, yeah.
So, I mean, let me say that was... I started writing that in 1996.
Yeah.
So I was not yet 30.
Wow.
When I started writing that. Came out in 97. I started work on it in 96.
It's got such an old head on it as well. It feels like it's got a looking over everything and going, here's me sharing my wisdom as such.
Right. Yeah. I don't know. Having a kid can do that to you.
Yeah, I guess so, yeah.
I had the kid in 95.
Observation, not old age, brings wisdom.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I've always felt old in my skin.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was like a summation. Maybe it's just the album you make when you're 30.
Yeah. I get that.
A little bit. It was like a summation of everything to date.
Yeah.
It feels a long time ago.
Yeah, no, and it feels to me as if it was one of the things you did essentially your longest run on. I know it was it was only that run, but was that the case? I can't.
Yes, it is. Yeah, that's the.
And how was that kind
longest,
of
longest? But what it was?
Were you just in that? Or were you doing other stuff at the same time? Were you kind of buried in that?
I was doing other stuff at the same time.
How easy was it to step out of that world? Because it was such an intricate and unique world. How was it to step out of that?
The problem wasn't the world. The problem was Spider.
Yeah.
Because once that fucker's inside your head, you know he's just pissing in the corner and he's looking for somewhere to take a shit and he's smoking bits of you.
Yeah. What a character, though. What a character.
And he's a bastard. And he's horrible. And he's a genuinely shitty human being in many, many ways.
On that exact sentence, how much of yourself is in Spider?
I always,
sorry to put that there how horrible he is. But
I always say that Spider is me in the first 40 minutes of the day.
Yeah.
When I'm just, fuck off, get away from me, I will stamp on you until you cannot shit straight.
Yeah.
Because I am not a morning person and I do not wake up well. Most of him is not me.
Yeah.
It's that unfettered childlike rage that anything that gets in my way will elicit in me when I've just woken up.
Yeah.
Because there is a lot childlike about him.
I'm glad we did this in London. I knew you would have had to be awake for at least 3 hours before we started this. Rather than the fear of knocking on your door to do this.
Oh, my God.
Oh, no, I've got a Spider. did you feel a freedom on it that maybe you'd kind of lost a little when
it was something
in the hands of superheroes and whatever else?
It was something that I earned back.
Yeah.
I think it was after like 3 years or whatever it was of doing steady superhero style work at Marvel. It wasn't all superhero style work, but there was 2 years on Excalibur and that was enough. I felt like I'd earned back the space to do whatever I wanted again.
Yeah.
And I don't think the book would have survived as long as it did if I hadn't done the commercial stuff for a couple of years and brought part of that audience over with me to transmit.
Completely. And did you feel, was there any nerves initially when it launched of how, or how...
Oh, yeah, because
attacking it was how bold it was.
I mean, just talking in commercial terms, it was the second wave of books from a newish sub-imprint at DC that was not doing terribly well. And at the time, science fiction books did not sell in the American market.
Right.
There had not been a hit science fiction book, ongoing book, in the American market, probably since American Flag.
Yeah.
And that would be 82, 83, around there. Science fiction historically never did well in the American market, so it was a big gamble for everybody.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there was a fair amount of trepidation.
Yeah.
And the sales were not, I mean, the sales were never great, but they certainly weren't so hot at the time.
Yeah.
I was just slightly ahead of the pack in the second wave, so when they shut the imprint down... They saved Transmetropolitan.
Yeah,
they brought
great.
It over and folded it into the Vertigo line.
Yeah. And do you feel the science of fiction setting was essential kind of structure to allow you to comment on a lot of things in society without it being a direct, like I think all the transhumanism and a lot of
right.
different
well, I mean,
race
I,
issues in there and everything else.
What I always say is this, science fiction, particularly European science fiction, has always been social fiction. You can trace that from Mary Shelley through H.G. Wells up to the present day. That's what British science fiction, European science fiction as a whole does.
Yeah.
The phrase I always use is using the future as a tool with which to examine the present day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That, to me, is what science fiction is for.
It feels like it kind of allows you to comment all the more, and without it seeming like Diamond thing. Somehow you can go to the extremes as Transmet regularly did, yet it seems that bit more subtle, despite how extreme you're going. You know,
I mean, I don't know if I'd ever use the word subtle in the same sentence as Transmetropolitan.
Yeah,
but you can be a little less didactic and come off as a little less worthy.
Yeah, of course.
You get that little bit of distance. That allows for a couple of different readings. Someone who doesn't share your particular political bent can look at it as just a funny or ridiculous bit of speculation.
Yeah.
But there was a lot of the present day in Transmetropolitan.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or what was then the present day.
Yeah. 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 Of course. Do you feel mentioning the term worthy there, do you think I can't think of another character other than the Spider Drewsome who is essentially at his core a worthy person in his beliefs and ethics, yet there's no worthiness in it because like he's carrying a gun that will make you shit yourself or things like that. Do you think that was kind of the key to get that across without it being that?
He's essentially a child, or at least at best an adolescent, and he's pure id.
Yeah.
So he can be worthy. He can have a core of ethics that he can espouse, frankly, till the cows come home. That doesn't mean he's not a piece of shit.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Perfect. That's true. How was it to go from writing for a piece of shit to return to superheroes and the like down the line after Transmet?
After that, when I got enticed back to Marvel, well, I mean, it took a fair amount of time to work Spider out of my
system.
Head.
Yeah.
And I think I probably wrote Crooked Little Vane before.
Right, yeah. So that's, for anyone who doesn't know, that's
Marvel.
That was your first novel.
Yeah, and a lot of that was probably, flushing the last of Transmet out of me. Just by spending that volume of time or that many words inside someone else's head.
Mm-hmm. And how was that to go to just step away from the visual medium?
I wrote that book largely by accident. What happened was I got a new film TV agent in Hollywood who was at the time the part of a big representation company.
Mm-hmm.
Then I got a phone call one day from this woman saying, "Hi, because you've signed with the agency, you actually inherit a New York literary editor." And that's me. "Hi, pleased to meet you. When are you writing a book?" "So, a little busy now. Nice to meet you. Go away." And she kept calling.
Yeah.
She kept calling and emailing saying, "Where's the book? Where's the book?" And I realised I was going to have to make this woman go away somehow.
It's the best reason to write a book ever.
So I sat down and I wrote, I think it was the first 8,000 words of Crooked Little Vane, which at that point was everything up to and including the Godzilla Bukkake sequence.
Right, excellent.
And I sent
spoiler
her, and
alert.
I emailed it to her, laughing.
Yeah.
And I remember saying, "She's going to read that. She's never going to bother me again.
Yep.
I've sent her the start of a completely unsaleable book. She's never going to call again. Thank God for that." 2 weeks later, she phones me and she's laughing.
Yeah.
She phones me and she's laughing and she says, I just sold the book to HarperCollins.
That's insanity.
Yeah, which meant I had to write it. So, Crooked Little Vein.
Amazing.
That, if you're reading Crooked Little Vein, is reading me essentially trying to find out if I can write a book.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or at least something. It's not a great novel, but I got to the end of it and I wrote something that looks like a book.
Yeah.
And it's probably not a book, but it looks like amazing. One. And discovered I loved the process.
Yeah, that's great. So before you then worked on your next novel, you returned to Marvel, as you
said. I did some stuff at Marvel.
Ultimate Galactus is one of my favourite kind of
that was
pieces.
That, which was a job I got by accident.
How was that?
Excuse me.
And again, it's quite nice because it was a decent amount of time to delve into this. So it wasn't, you've got a short run, you've got this or that. It felt like it was a big story crossing over everything.
That whole thing happened by accident. And if I had my time all over again, I would do that thing completely differently.
Oh, really?
Because what happened was Mark Miller emailed me and said, hello, mate, I'm supposed to be doing the Ultimate Galactus event for Marvel Ultimate Comics. But I'm really stuck for time and I can't do it yet. Would you be all right with writing a 5-month long prequel? And that'd buy me the time to write the thing. So I said, tell me what you know about it. And it was like 3 lines at this point. So Ultimate Nightmare, that first 5-issue series.
Yeah.
It's basically me vamping for 5 months doing a little horror story to set up...
to fill a gap.
To set up Mark's event. Yeah. I did that. A phone call from Marvel saying, well, Mark's not ready yet. Is there a way to like do a post-prequel sequel? it was partway... I'm like, oh, Christ.
Jesus.
I can try, but I really don't know what's going on, so we're going to have to like wing this a little bit. And it was partway through that, I guess, that it became clear that Mark just wasn't going to write it at all.
Yeah.
So then they had to set up the 3rd miniseries.
Amazing.
That I had to write too. So
yeah.
I didn't know I was writing the event until essentially halfway through it.
And then you went, hang on, this isn't the intro. This is, we're halfway through the actual story that we're telling here.
Yeah. So if I had my time again, I would have done it different.
That's amazing. I love that. The other one of that era that I was I really enjoyed and I found fascinating was Thunderbolts.
Right.
How was that for you to get your teeth into villains rather than heroes, essentially?
That, I remember Joker.
Or did it feel exactly the same as it's not really what I want to be writing? Or
well, you know? If you look back at most of the superhero fiction I've done since Transmetropolitan, it's still pretty much all about horrible people.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So what that was Joe Quesada phoning me and pitching me this. And they just had the basic idea. They knew roughly, they knew the characters they wanted to use, I think. But what sold me, they wanted to use Norman Osborn, the Green Goblin.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I suddenly remembered the way John Romita used to draw him. Norman Osborn, when he was angry or starting to lose it, he always had bug eyes.
Yeah, yeah,
and was constantly sweating.
Yeah.
And I just suddenly saw, you know, him, that guy running like this secret militarized superhero base. Probably, you know, off his tits on Adderall and antipsychotics and just losing it or being on the verge of losing it constantly while still determined to kill Spider-Man, even though Spider-Man isn't involved and isn't there. But it's always there.
Yeah, of course.
I thought, what an insane
it's great fun,
idea
right?
for what was up to that point, you know, a pretty straight, generic superhero book.
Yeah.
I don't know if it was bad or not. I know I had some good writers on it.
Yeah.
I never read it.
Yeah.
But as far as I knew, it was a pretty much straight down the line generic superhero book.
Yeah.
And they were, I think, they were giving me Mike Deodato. who's got a really weird range to him.
Yeah.
I was delighted to see he brought some of that range into the book, because he can do straight superhero stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
But he can also do like hyper-realistic, high-contrast contemporary stuff. It's a huge range, like most artists of his region do in the comics form. And it just sounded like a lot of fun.
Yeah, that's great.
Because, you know, they, at that point at Marvel, they'd taken most limitations off. I would really have to push it at Marvel to get a phone call saying, no, you can't do that.
Yeah. That's got to be a good thing that seems to have been the way it's gone now, that limitations are kind of...
Every
book seems to have its own area.
It's that basic understanding of the medium that, you know, there are no filters and you have to add them artificially. And why would you do that?
Yeah.
I mean, I imagine it's a lot different if you're working at Marvel Studio.
Yeah.
I mean, as much as, you know, I was thinking about this on the way up here that even the comics that we think of as generic comics are weird.
Yeah.
If you look at the Avengers movie, if that story had been told as a comic, we would have thought that was a fairly straight down the line superhero book.
Yeah.
Common Old Garden. Yeah. There's not a lot in there that would make it extraordinarily weird.
No, yeah, you're right.
And yet, you do that same story in film. And it becomes like the third biggest movie of all time because nobody's seen, the general audience hasn't seen a story like that before.
And I mean, you just look at, obviously, I mean, we're recording this at the end of October. It'll be going out in a few weeks. But you look at the reaction to Marvel's recent announcements of all the films and everything they've got lined up for years to come. And you know that.
Nine. Yeah.
It's crazy, isn't it? What's your plans kind of in the film or TV areas and world, if there's anything that you can talk about? I'm sure there may or may not be, but
there's a lot I can't talk about.
Does it
about
interest
right
you
now?
or what do you kind of think of Marvel's? I mean, for me, I think it's kind of an ignorant thing that for me, any superhero film is being made, I'm pleased that that's happening. I'm pleased that that's the thing that's happening. Some they will nail, some they will do a bad job of, but I'm pleased that it's not just on the table, it's the main course at the moment, it feels like there's...
Yeah, I'll be honest, I only saw the Avengers because I know the director.
Yeah.
But it's just, you know, not particularly where my interests lie when I'm going to entertainment.
Yeah, but, sure.
I'd rather rewatch the thick of it or something.
Do you feel that that in film the restrictions are still there too much? So, how would they make a Transmet series or film? Do you think we're not at a place cinematically or society?
I don't think we ever will, because what you're talking about is an R-rated political drama that also requires an extremely expensive science fiction setting.
Yeah, of course. It's a hell of a task right there, right?
There's been interest lately.
Because TV, the way TV is going at the moment, the boundaries that are being pushed down with TV.
But there was a guy, a very famous cable television network, said, we'd love to do Transmet Metropolitan.
Mm.
And I said, that's great. What about the language? And he said, I think we're allowed one fuck per 45 minutes now. I think it's three shits, but I think we can say piss a lot.
And did you use that entire quota in the rest of the conversation as you politely hung up on
I liked here's the guy, but I did actually use up that quota in the next sentence.
Yeah, I'd imagine.
You know, it was very kind of them to ask, but if they can't preserve the voice,
it's not going to happen.
And they knew that. They just had to ask the question.
I still get excited every time there's rumblings of Preacher being turned into a series and things like that. Because there's certain ones that, you know, I could see a ways that they could hold the integrity of these things.
Because Seth and Evan have got that.
Oh, really? Have they? I wasn't
Seth
even aware of that. Yeah,
Rogen
yeah.
And Evan Goldberg are the producers on that.
Oh, wow.
And they get shit done.
They do. And it feels that they would respect it and do it right.
Well, yeah, they would, absolutely. Yeah. I was delighted when I heard
that's great news. I didn't even know that.
I can't remember for the life of me where they've got it placed now. It Might be Showtime. I can't remember. Showtime would be probably a good place for it.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's Seth and Evan, so I'm expecting that to get made.
That's great. So yeah, is there anything that you can or cannot talk about? Or is there stuff that you just like?
I've got this weird deal that I should explain. It's called a blind script deal.
Yes, I read about this.
With Universal Cable Productions.
Mm-hmm.
And a blind script deal is a bit of Hollywood jargon that's arcane. It means this. We all agree that I'm going to write a script for them.
Mm-hmm.
We don't decide until afterwards what it is.
Right. Is that a good or a bad thing? I'd say that's kind of nice, right, to have that comfort of, right, we're going to make something
thing,
here.
Yeah, yeah, we're going to pay you to write a script and develop it at the very least, and we'll all agree on it is what we'll all agree on what it is after we've done the deal.
Yeah, that's great. So it's similar to how, as you said, it felt like doing 3 years on Superheroes earned you the right back to do Transmit, have that freedom. It feels like this... All the work you've done leading up this earns you the right to go, yeah, we want to do a deal and work with you. We have faith in what you can deliver and do.
Maybe. You know? Maybe. I don't know. I'm working with Gail Ann Hurd on that, whose name you probably know. She was James Cameron's producer
on Aliens. Wow, yeah.
And Terminator. And, of course, now she's the producer on The Walking Dead.
That's exciting, then.
And she's fun because she's a football fan.
Oh, wow, really?
Yeah. So every time we meet, it's always 15 minutes of other people having to sit around while we're talking about, you know, the World Cup.
Brilliant.
Or Arsenal. She's an Arsenal fan.
So, who's your team?
Nobody's perfect.
What's your team?
Well, I haven't got one anymore. It was Ipswich when I was a kid.
Yeah.
Because it was less embarrassing than supporting Southend United.
Yeah. You see, I was a Millwall fan, but going to school in Southend, obviously it was, painful.
There were a couple of Millwall fans in Thundersley back in the day. Yeah.
My dad would have been one of them, and then, a couple.
These days I've stripped myself to just watching international football. I love the World Cup.
It's great fun.
Any time Brazil gets the shit beaten out of them, you know.
Yeah. It's always a laugh. Have you got any ideas what you'll be doing this series on?
That is what I can't talk about.
That's what
we're in the process of deciding.
Right. And are you going to be coming up with a completely original story? Have you got access to their back catalogue and archives?
I've got access to their back catalogue. There's a couple of original ideas we're knocking around. It might be fun to go and play with their back catalogue.
Yeah.
They teased me terribly. They said, you know, because when we started talking about the back catalogue, you know, something like, I don't know, Columbo. Columbo. I would love to write Columbo. And we can't do that. It was just an example.
Imagine Columbo a reboot.
Yes. Wouldn't it be lovely?
Columbo 2099.
No. Columbo present day with... you could just go the other way. It's Tim Roth.
Yeah, definitely.
Did you ever watch Lie to Me?
Yeah, I loved that show.
That was great. They should have just renamed it. Tim Roth shouts at people for an hour.
And
he slaps them and then shouts.
He was great in it, though. It was a very enjoyable... I watched all of that in about... a month or two, because it was one that I'd always seen and thought, nah, doesn't look like it's for me. Because I think I saw a clip, and again, he was shouting in his Cockney accent or whatever it was. It was like, go away. But then a girlfriend at the time was ill, and she was, I'd come in and she was all right, and she was watching a lot of it, and she had it on at one point, and I realised that she had fallen asleep, and I'd watched three more episodes. I was like, I'm into this now, aren't I? I've not gone stop. I've, like, when Netflix has said, do you want to watch the next one? I've not paused it. I've just said, all right, let's keep going.
To have seen a final season where they just jettison the rest of the cast.
Yeah,
and it was just Tim Roth wandering around and shouting at people.
Yeah,
that would have been beautiful.
Reading their body language. Yeah. So what's next? We'll start to wrap up as soon as we're over the hour mark. But what's next for you? What's your plans? I mean, we've not even touched on Gun Machine.
No,
that was. Is that your most recent?
Most recent novel, yeah. After that, I did a long short story called Dead Pig Collector.
Yes, of course, of course.
And after we're done here, I'm going home and I'm doing the redraft on the last bit of Normal.
Right.
Which is a novella I got coming out next year.
Excellent.
And then I intend to spend the winter months finally writing the non-fiction book that I signed the contract for like a bloody year ago or something.
Yeah. That's great, though.
So, yeah.
We were discussing before we came on air that the winter months lend themselves in many ways to just hibernating away and writing. Do you find that's your most productive time creatively, or is it more your productive time is when they fucking tell you this is when you've got to be productive?
That does happen. That does happen. I don't know. I think I'm just embracing winter this year. I mean, look at me. I turned up in a sweater and an Icelandic wool hoodie.
Good work.
I'm embracing winter this year. If I could have a cave and a little fire,
yeah,
I would. I'm very much in the mood to just go full hermit this year and sit and think about things like a mad philosopher in the woods.
Perfect.
I've reached that stage.
Do you find when you're writing you need to focus on one thing, or will you be jumping about from the fiction novel?
Honestly, it depends on the job and what it needs. The non-fiction thing, I'm going to have an internet window open in the background
to
reference stuff. When I'm writing prose, provided it's not particularly research heavy, then yes, I can just switch everything off, put some headphones on.
Lose yourself in that.
Yeah.
But do you always work on one project at a time, or will you be writing your prose and then doing some comic book stuff?
I'm usually multitasking because I don't believe in writer's block per se, at least not for me.
Mm-hmm.
But you'll sit down one day and there's a job in front of you and you just haven't got it in you to do it.
I agree. I don't think there's writer's block, but I think there is days when you don't want to write, and that's a different thing. That's kind of a choice in a way.
I'll be looking at this and I'm like, I just don't give a shit about you today.
Yeah.
So, but if I'm doing like two or three different other projects, I can switch. I was like, all right, if I can't do that, let's open this one.
I find,
and it'll turn out I've got it for one of those today. I'm still productive.
One of my keys to completing anything is having something else I want to do less.
Yeah.
Because then it's like, right, I don't want to just start on it, so I'll work on this, and that's kind of that's key to it. I feel on the creativity
so I'm
side.
I'm producing every day, maybe not on what someone wants me to be producing.
Yeah.
But fuck them.
Are there any little projects that you've had sitting or bubbling or waiting that have never come in, or is it just kind of a constant? You get to create what you wish to create.
There's always a few that die on the vine somewhere along the way, but you know, you stick them in a folder, or you just put your hands up and say, "Oh well,
that didn't work."
Pointless crying about it for the rest of your life. If it's dead, it's dead, I'm afraid.
That's fair enough.
And some just percolate for a long time. Like I say, I've been thinking about this non-fiction book for more than a year now.
Wow.
Probably going on 18 months, and it hasn't quite settled, but I can feel it coming on now.
Yeah.
So once Normal's done and a couple of TV scripts I've got to write, I think I'm spending the winter in that and the next tree stories.
Well, perfect. I think we should wrap up and let you get back into a dark room where you can focus and hibernate.
What a bloody good idea.
Where can people keep up to date with you, or keep up with what are you into that side of the internet and all that? Or
I've begun my internet hermitage for the winter.
Good
I've
work.
Switched off Twitter.
Good work.
You can find me at my weekly newsletter that I will email to you if you subscribe at orbitaloperations.com.
Perfect.
And most mornings I will rant a bit, or at least mumble at you, at morning.computer, which is an actual website address.
Brilliant. That's perfect. Well, thank you very, very, very much for coming on. I look forward to hearing everything and seeing everything that comes along. And next, thank you very much. Have a safe journey back to Essex.
My pleasure. Cheers, mate.
You've been listening to Scrooby's Picks Discretion Pieces.
There we have it. That was... Why did my voice go like that? That's not how my voice is. I've not got a high-pitched voice like that. Anyway, there we have it, is what I meant to say. Not there we have it. There we have it. That was... that was a Warren Ellis. An absolute pleasure and honour to talk to the guy. I think I kind of held down my fanboy in slightly. So, yeah, that was good and very enjoyable. Thank you for tuning in. Next week, we have Jodie-Anne Bickley, who is just fantastic. I'm a massive fan of this girl. If you don't know her story, then you need to tune in. It's one of the most amazing stories. I'll kind of give you a brief teaser now. She's a spoken word artist, and then when she was 23, I think, she got bit by a tick, and it basically made her brain explode, and she had to relearn how to walk and read and write, and it was absolutely heartbreaking. But the idea she came up with to help her get through this has ended up helping thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of people all over the world, and has had her garner international acclaim and praise for the good things that she's done. So yeah, tune in next week for that one. Please subscribe if you can. That really helps. It means you'll get the podcast as soon as we put it up. It's every Wednesday, but it means if it goes up a little bit early, you'll get it a little bit early. So subscribe on iTunes or at scroobiespip.co.uk on the Distraction Pieces podcast tab. That's your lot. See you next week.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.